Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 386. Sunday, January 3rd, 2021.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey, everybody, Happy New Year. So I'm speaking these words to you on Saturday afternoon. Today is the 2nd, but I'm thinking the date stamp at the start of this podcast was probably somewhat after January 2nd, 2021. You know, the first time I wrote 2021 was at the top of the first page of notes for this episode, and I got it wrong. First time I tried to write the new year, it didn't come out right. And in fact, I went way back in time. I started to write 01 instead of 21. Anyway, I got a nice piece of feedback from Leap Minion, which I'm not going to try to read here at the beginning of this podcast, as I have a complicated knot that I'm going to try to untie here on the first part of the podcast. And I don't want to mix in any of the themes that Leap Minion's feedback addresses. I want to keep this clean. So maybe I'll get to his feedback in this episode and maybe not. This is actually dangerous. I've got a couple pages of handwritten notes and many, many browser tabs open. The topic here, it started off with a revisit to peak oil. So Danger Dead Nettles, who goes by a variety of names, but that's the one that I see on Instagram all the time, sent me a link to a Bloomberg article about peak oil. And the Bloomberg article has the provocative title, "Peak Oil is Suddenly Upon Us." It's, you know, thick black letters on a vibrant yellow background, and the heaviest typeface is reserved for the words "peak oil." And it starts off, I'm not going to read it to you. It's long, and editing the audiobook style presentation, it's way too time consuming. So forgive me, I'm just going to summarize. But it starts off by saying, look, if a couple years ago you had said that 2020 would mark the peak of oil production, well, people working in the industry at all levels would have thought you were an idiot or crazy. And now here it is. You know, peak oil, as in oil production, has fallen in 2020 compared to previous years. Has it actually peaked? Well, nobody knows, you know. And in fact, it's unlikely, I think, that it's peaked. I think that after the pandemic, as, you know, demand for transportation increases to pre-pandemic levels or close to them, that we will see a ramping up in oil production. But right now, the supply outstrips the demand. If you had told anybody in the peak oil community 10 years ago that by 2020, yes, production would have peaked, but it would be because demand has fallen off and because electric vehicle sales have surged, you would have been accused of being a hopium addict, and, you know, and other unpleasant labels would be affixed to you. But that's where we stand right now, and it's largely because of the pandemic. But I just want to point out that the peak oil that captured my imagination back in 2007, 2008, was the scenario whereby the demand for petroleum continued to grow and just the natural scarcity of it caused a constraint such that there just wasn't enough to meet the demand. And what we have now is the opposite. There is more oil available than there is demand for it. And a lot of that is just demand destruction because of, you know, a devastated economy, devastated global economy. But also, well, I'm getting ahead of myself, but I'll jump ahead in the article here. Electric vehicle sales, while internal combustion vehicle sales have fallen dramatically this year. For example, PSA Group, which includes lots of different car manufacturers that you've heard of, including Fiat Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, Ram, Fiat, Alfa Romeo, Maserati, and the French brands Peugeot and Citroën. Forgive me, French people, if I've mispronounced your car companies. They're all in the PSA group. And PSA group's internal combustion engine vehicle sales have fallen by 50% this year. But their electric vehicle sales have increased by 1,284%. Ford, likewise, has seen, it looks like, about a 35% drop in their, and I say about because this scale, this graphic that I'm looking at, it doesn't have very fine numbering on it. But it looks to be not quite 50%, but still a very significant fall off in their vehicle sales this year. And yet their electric vehicle sales are up over 50%. Same with Volkswagen and Daimler. And to a lesser extent, Hyundai, Kia, BMW, well, and Tesla just is Tesla. I mean, they don't have any ICE, any internal combustion engine vehicles. They never sold any. So, you know, their sales there haven't fallen off. Their total auto sales and their EV sales are one and the same, and they're positive. They're growing. So this article, this was in Bloomberg, and they frequently make reference to statistics that come from BNEF. And I've discovered that BNEF is the Bloomberg New Energy and Finance Organization. It's an investigatory arm of Bloomberg, and they focus on, well, let's just go to their website. Bloomberg NEF is a leading provider of primary research on clean energy, advanced transport, digital industry, innovative materials, and commodities. And innovative materials will be big here in a couple minutes, I think. I don't know. Actually, I don't know if the pandemic was a boon to electric vehicle sales or if the continued growth in electric vehicle sales is really just a trend with momentum, you know, a pre-existing trend. But bike sales, you know, just pedal bicycle sales took off during the pandemic. And as motorized transportation or ICE transportation demand was falling off, ethanol, you know, which is a product made from corn, grown primarily in the American Midwest, which used to be mixed into gasoline, you know, to extend gasoline, the demand for gasoline has fallen off a cliff. So ethanol produced for a gasoline additive is now going into hand sanitizers, according to BNEF. But they're just quoting, you know, BNEF's research, and there's a projection of internal combustion engine sales going forward to from now to 2040, alongside plug-in hybrids, fuel cell vehicles, and electric vehicles. And pure electric vehicles account for more than 50% of sales in 2040, according to these projections. And hydrogen fuel cell vehicles are a negligible portion of this graph. And plug-in hybrids are they're bigger than hydrogen fuel cell, but they're still pretty small compared to pure electric vehicles or, you know, the remnant of ICE vehicle sales. Now, one of the later headings here is batteries for everything on the road. And there's a list of all the different car companies that are coming out with electric vehicles in the coming year. And so we're coming up on batteries now. And for the most part, the batteries that are used in electric cars, and entirely in terms of commercial sales, they're lithium-ion batteries. And if you'll recall, when I had Jim Kunstler, Dmitry Orlov, John Michael Greer, and Chris Martinson all in a room, and I asked them a question about electric vehicles a few years ago, Chris Martinson gave a very dismissive answer about how, you know, people who think that electric vehicles could replace the internal combustion engine fleet just can't do math, because there's no way there's no way that we can ever come up with enough lithium to create enough batteries to power all the cars, you know, and replace gasoline-powered cars. And I've returned to that from time to time. It didn't strike me as convincing at the time, but, you know, not sure where to start here. Okay, let's just start with lithium itself. If you look at the periodic table, the lightest, most abundant element in the universe is hydrogen, followed by helium. Hydrogen was all created during the Big Bang. I mean, it is the simplest element. And helium, while a lot of it apparently was created in the Big Bang, I'm no expert on that, but I do know that stars, like our star, Sol, create additional helium as they fuse hydrogen atoms, you know, The power of the sun is the power of nuclear fusion, and it is the fusion of hydrogen atoms primarily into helium atoms. Well, the next item on the periodic table with an atomic weight of 3 is lithium. And from my perspective, I was thinking, you know, the simpler, lighter elements are going to be the most abundant in the universe. And it turns out that that's not the case. And I'm not going to go into a huge amount of detail here or start reading long passages from Wikipedia at you, but I'm going to read just a couple sentences here. There is a Wikipedia article, Abundance of the Chemical Elements. And third paragraph reads, "The abundance of chemical elements in the universe is dominated by the large amounts of hydrogen and helium, which were produced in the Big Bang. Remaining elements making up only about 2% of the universe." So take out all the hydrogen and all the helium in the universe, and you've removed everything except 2%, you know, of elemental matter. And I don't know how dark matter enters into this calculation, so we'll set that aside. "Remaining elements make up only 2% of the universe, were largely produced by supernovae," not sure how you pronounce the plural of supernova, "and certain red giant stars. Lithium, beryllium, and boron are rare because although they are produced by nuclear fusion, they are then destroyed by other reactions in the stars." And then later in the article, or maybe it's a different article, I don't see it on my screen right now, but I remember something about how some stars that are like in a binary with a very massive object like a black hole or a neutron star, they have more lithium in them than most stars of their type. And the hypothesized reason is that because the gravitational pull of that other object, be it a black hole or a neutron star, pulls the lithium out of the core or keeps it from sinking into the core of the star where it would be destroyed, because it can be destroyed at relatively low temperatures, you know, relatively low when we're talking about the interior of stars. All right, I am closing that tab. I'll say no more on that topic other than, yes, it's a very simple element. It seems like it should be abundant in the universe, but the same processes or the same environments where it's created also destroy it. But electric vehicle sales are climbing. They all require batteries. Lithium is in, you know, it is a finite constituent of, you know, planet Earth. And another important thing about lithium is that it never occurs just as a metal unto itself. You know, just quoting very briefly, from the Wikipedia entry on lithium. "Lithium is a chemical element with atomic number 3. It is a soft, silvery white alkali metal. Under standard conditions, it is the lightest metal and the lightest solid element. Like all alkali metals, lithium is largely reactive and flammable and must be stored in mineral oil. When cut, it exhibits metallic luster, but moist air corrodes it quickly to a dull silvery gray, then blackish tarnish. It never occurs freely in nature, but only in usually ionic compounds, such as pegmatic materials." And I'm not even going to click on that link. I don't know what pegmatic materials are. But continuing. "Which were once the main source of lithium. Due to its solubility as an ion, it is present in ocean water and is commonly obtained from brines. Lithium metal is isolated electrolytically from a mixture of lithium chloride and potassium chloride." So anyway, you're never going to find the mother lode of lithium because it doesn't occur as a pure metal. It has to be refined into that usable form. All right, closing that tab. And back to Bloomberg here. This bit I am going to read because I can just read it to you quicker than I can summarize it. Just this 4 paragraphs. "Batteries are a technology, not a fuel, which means the more that are produced, the cheaper they are to make. In fact, every time the global supply of batteries doubles, the cost drops by about 18%, according to data trafficked by BNEF." Again, Bloomberg New Energy and Finance. "Historically, EVs, electric vehicles, have been more expensive to build than gasoline cars. That's changing. The past year saw the first companies reaching the holy grail in battery packs, a cost of $100 per kilowatt hour. That's the point that analysts have long believed will bring the cost of building electric cars in line with similar gasoline-fueled vehicles. After that, EVs will only get cheaper. Volkswagen, the biggest automaker by cars sold, confirmed that its batteries had reached the $100 threshold for its 2020 ID.3 sedan and upcoming 4 ID.4 compact SUV. China's CATL, the world's biggest battery supplier, also claimed $100 battery nirvana as it struck deals across the auto industry. Not to be outdone, Tesla hosted an elaborate Battery Day event in September. The audience watched from a parking lot full of Teslas as CEO Elon Musk showed off plans to manufacture battery cells, a first for any automaker, and to reduce battery costs 56% by 2023. Even if Musk's estimates are a few years too optimistic, as they sometimes are, it would still put Tesla years ahead of mainstream industry forecasts. Mass-market EVs became possible only with the falling price of batteries. What comes next could be a virtuous cycle of cost declines. As battery prices improve, customers will snap up more electric cars, making battery prices even cheaper. Okay, so let's pause there. We're going to come back to Bloomberg, but I'm going to pause there. Battery prices are coming down. But lithium is in short supply. Is there going to be enough lithium to accommodate the switch, the ongoing switch from internal combustion engine vehicles to pure electric vehicles? Up till now, and still, I think it's still the case, if you're buying an electric vehicle, you have priced in your own values. You are valuing the fact that you're not burning fossil fuels, or that with your purchase, you are advancing the material know-how, you know, of getting people around using electricity rather than gasoline. But in a strictly, you know, in a very strict, non-ideological cost-benefit analysis, until very recently, electric vehicles simply have not been something that you would even consider, because you have to pay more to get less. They can't travel as far in a day, you know, as gasoline-powered vehicles. Until recently, you know, they haven't had the power for, you know, pulling heavy loads or quick acceleration. Electric vehicles just couldn't rival fossil fuel vehicles, you know, particularly when it comes to hauling heavy loads, diesel-powered vehicles. Basically, you had to pay a premium for your good intentions, which has held back the industry. Well, apparently, we are crossing the threshold now where you no longer have to put down your own money to support your values in terms of, you know, your environmental values. When it's just cheaper to buy an electric vehicle that is similar in its capacities to an ICE vehicle, well, then more and more people will choose the electric vehicle, particularly given the maintenance costs, because petroleum is corrosive. So people who know more about this, please send in your corrections. But, you know, the bottom line here is that ICE vehicles require more maintenance, and entropy weighs heavier on them just because of the way they operate compared to electric vehicles. So with battery prices coming down and their performance getting better, you no longer have to be a fanatic of any kind to decide to buy an electric vehicle. For more and more people, it's just going to become the nuts and bolts, dollars and cents, clear best alternative. All right, and then there's a bit on Europe, and it's simply legislating, you know, that vehicle efficiency has to increase dramatically in a short period, which is driving sales, you know, in Europe. And similar initiatives are going to be taking place in California. Okay, so next, people who make money just by investing, which is to say, placing a bet, making a decision about what's going to happen, and then validating that decision by putting your money down on it. Investors are turning away from fossil fuel and turning toward electric vehicles. And also, I'm cutting out all talk of electrical power transmission and, you know, storage of grid energy. That also involves lithium-ion batteries. But it's also a topic that will get me hopelessly lost in the weeds if I try to pursue it right now. So setting that aside. So now, again, reading from the Bloomberg piece. At a London hotel in February, BP, British Petroleum's new chief executive, Bernard Looney, delivered his first speech from a podium bedazzled with a green Reimagine BP logo. He described one of the industry's most far-reaching plans to cut net emissions to zero in 30 years. 2 months later, Royal Dutch Shell said that it, too, would zero out emissions by 2050. In May came Total SA, France's biggest oil producer. Spain's Repsol and Italy's Eni had made their own pledges back in 2019. While key details varied and were sometimes conspicuously lacking, net zero emissions became a sort of demarcation line drawn through the oil industry. Lined up against the old guard and the oil companies that no longer want to be known as oil companies. It's difficult to tell which came first for the transitioners. Did a changing outlook for long-term demand result in an overhaul in business strategies? Or were the forecasts for peak oil meant to justify a new business strategy born of public pressure? Perhaps a bit of both. And for the end result, it may not matter. For investors, one thing is clear. The oil patch has lost its shimmer. Exxon, which was the most valuable company in the world as recently as 2013, was removed from the Dow Jones Industrial Average Index this year. It's now vying to remain above the market value of Next Era Energy, Inc., a Florida-based mega utility focused on wind and solar, which briefly overtook it in October. Tesla's stock this year has been on a record-breaking tear, surpassing the value of the next five automakers combined. Okay, I'm just stepping outside of the reading here, and I'm just saying, to me, that is crazy. That is absolutely insane that Tesla would be valued more than the next five, you know, most valued automakers in the world combined. That's just nuts. But, you know, that's the stock market. So, continuing from the article, stock markets reward growth. Just look at Amazon's sky-high stock price back when online retail was still a novelty, or Netflix's valuation when cable TV still dominated. When it comes to the future of oil demand, the market is speaking very clearly. Okay, so this being Bloomberg, it dwells on, you know, the financial aspects of this at length. If that's your deal, you know, I'll link to this in the show notes, but I'm going to push on. So skipping several sections, the next one that I want to condense and relate to you is sunshine is the new oil. And what they mean by that is that, you know, for most of the history of these technologies, electric generation for the grid was a completely separate endeavor from creating energy to move people and products across the landscape. And it was largely a divide between drillers, you know, looking for liquid fuels, and miners looking for coal. But with, you know, the electrification of transport, basically whatever it is that we use to create electricity now, you know, the electricity that charged the device that you're using to listen to this podcast right now is the same energy infrastructure which charges the batteries in electric vehicles. And right now, and I don't know this to be true, but this article claims that, quote, solar power is now the cheapest form of new energy capacity in most of the world, which means that as power markets grow to meet the new demand from EVs, oil is being largely displaced by power from the sun, close quote. And then here's a chart with, you know, projected use of solar energy compared to other methods from the past. And again, this is from Bloomberg NEF, as well as the International Energy Agency and an organization I'm not familiar with, OKHoextra. Don't know them. But then I think the most important thing the article has to say, and it's just in the concluding paragraph, and they don't really elaborate on it, is this. When discussing their forecasts, energy analysts take great pains to point out that they are not making predictions of what will happen, but rather presenting different scenarios about what could happen. As Birol frequently points out, the timing of peak oil depends entirely on what the world does next. That brings us to the end of the Bloomberg article. Closing the tab. Getting closer to where I was hoping to go with this. It seems that battery technology is very important in terms of the transition away from petroleum and, you know, carbon-based fuels and toward a more renewable, we won't say totally renewable because a lot of electricity is still generated by coal, but batteries are very important. So back to Chris Martinson's assertion that there's just simply is not enough lithium to meet the demand. Well, I wanted to get an idea. I wanted to get a perspective about the future of lithium-ion batteries and whether or not there is enough lithium to supply the demand, but I didn't want to get it from anybody who was talking about automotive transportation or anybody who was interested in fossil fuels or who was pushing for electric vehicles or the electrification of the fossil fuel economy. I wanted to just get away from all of those agendas and see what people who just don't care about all that stuff have to say about this when they dig into it. So I'm on a website called Pro Tool Reviews, and they're all about power tools. Like, the various tabs which describe the different sections at the top of this website are by trade, power tools, hand tools, OPE, which is outdoor powered equipment, accessories, fasteners, buying guides, brands. So these are people who just care about tools. So the article is there a lithium ion battery shortage coming? And the author of this piece is, a very young man from my perspective. His name is Kenny Kohler, and his bio reads as follows. On the clock, Kenny dives deep to discover the practical limits and comparative differences for all kinds of tools. Off the clock, his faith and love for his family are his top priorities, and you'll typically find him in the kitchen, on his bike, he's an Iron Man, or taking folks out for a day of fishing on Tampa Bay. So Kenny, who's all about the tools, writes the following. Having spoken with several industry insiders from different companies, it's clear that there is a lithium-ion battery shortage brewing. The blame falls largely on the auto industry, which currently consumes more of this resource than any other industry. While it certainly seems like we live in the golden age of cordless tool innovation, a storm is coming that you may not have heard about: the finite resource of lithium-ion batteries. What's eating up the lithium? According to an Engineering.com report, most of the global lithium supply exists in Chile, Argentina, and Bolivia. Between strict controls and varying business policies, not enough mining of lithium exists to keep up with demand. Letting lithium mining go completely unchecked also presents a poor option. In Chile's case, it might just be smart business. By putting tight controls on how much lithium they mine, the supply lasts longer. We'll hold off on the OPEC comparisons for now. The automotive industry bears the blame for the quick shift from sustainable production to the present lithium-ion battery shortage. Tesla makes one sweet-looking car, but they use more than 5,000 lithium-ion cells on the low end. The high-end models contain more than 7,000 cells. Compare that to the 3 cells in a compact 12-volt battery pack. Even the largest battery packs for cordless outdoor power equipment use between 15 and about 42 cells. Battery-powered EV vehicles simply use hundreds or even thousands of times more lithium-ion cells. Of course, the EV industry isn't the only possible strain on supply, just the largest. Environmentally conscious groups around the country want more green spaces, in scare quotes, green spaces. These areas regulate or even ban the use of gas-powered lawn equipment. Short of moving to hydrogen fuel cells, all those commercial lawnmowers potentially have massive lithium-ion cell needs. A look inside a Tesla or even a Greenworks lithium-ion zero-turn motor shows they use 18,650 or 21,700 lithium-ion cells. These very same cells fuel a majority of cordless power tools. So, again, the author of this is interested in the future of cordless power tools. And he's saying, yeah, the electric vehicles are eating up a lot of them, but also places that demand that we stop using fossil fuels to cut the grass are putting even more strain on the limited supply of lithium-ion power cells. What to expect moving forward? As demand rises with the popularity and/or regulation of battery-powered cars and lawn equipment, we expect the lithium-ion battery shortage to start having a greater effect. On EV vehicles, which is redundant, that's like ATM machine, on EV vehicles, people already experience longer wait times after placing an order. And I'm going to pause there and just say, when I first read that Bloomberg piece and looked at the graph that showed all of the ICE vehicle sales falling off and at the same time electric vehicle sales continuing strong, I looked at Tesla and I thought, you don't just go to the the dealership and pick out your Tesla and drive away. You order one, and several months later, you get a call from somebody saying, yes, you can come pick up your Tesla. So pandemic or no pandemic, when your Tesla, which you paid for months ago, is available, you go and get it. So, you know, whether you are commuting as much as you used to do, it doesn't really matter, particularly at this stage in the game for Tesla buyers. You know, I said until either right now or in the slight future, you know, slightly into the future, to choose an electric vehicle, you had to have some motivation other than just getting the most for your money. And with Tesla, I think a lot of it's just prestige. So again, while, you know, the differing needs, transportation needs of people, which are fluctuating because of the pandemic, while that affects normal sales, we'll call ICE vehicles normal, while that, you know, the fluctuating demand for transportation is going to affect that market, which is, you know, still the vast majority of cars sold, it's not going to affect Tesla buyers, at least not Tesla buyers of 2020. If a few years down the road, Tesla is, as they promised to, they're selling a, you know, $25,000 vehicle, well, I think sales of that kind of vehicle will fluctuate depending on transportation needs. But right now, the Tesla is still a status symbol. You know, you don't buy it to move your body from one place to another. You buy it to demonstrate your inclusion in an elite tribe. Of course, on the OPE side, and you will remember OPE is outdoor power equipment, of course, on the OPE side, most of the demand lies with consumer products. This includes push mowers, string trimmers, and blowers. At the moment, those supplies seem sufficient for residential markets. The commercial side of the industry seems slower in moving from gas to battery. Not enough demand exists for these products yet to see if the lithium shortage is having an effect on delivering those orders. Most likely, the supply of cordless power tools will suffer. This will likely take two forms. Straight out of your high school economics class. First, as the supply tightens up, you might have trouble getting replacement batteries quickly. Second, you can almost certainly expect to see prices start to creep upwards. Supply and demand always comes into play. But that's not the end of the article. The next heading is, don't hit the panic button. Yet. Now is not the time to go out and buy as many lithium-ion batteries as you can store. So I'm not going to read this whole thing, but basically they're just saying, look, even if you buy the things and put them on a shelf and don't use them, they still degrade. And they degrade about as quickly as they would if you were using them. 3 to 5 years is the average lifespan of one of these lithium-ion battery packs, whether you use it or not. So it would be stupid to stock up. And then it concludes with what to expect moving forward. Finally, manufacturers keep an eye on these things. And they're not waiting around to see what happens. Honda and GM are partnering to work on the next generation of batteries, with a focus on the automotive industry. This agreement follows its 2017 announcement of a partnership to target hydrogen fuel cells. If the automotive side makes the shift to a different cell, it will ease up the demand for lithium. This would allow cordless tools to continue moving forward using current technology. Isn't it hilarious how this always comes back to the needs of the guy with, you know, the cordless drill? If the automotive side makes the shift to a different cell, it will ease up the demand for lithium. This would allow cordless tools to continue moving forward using current technology. Shortage or not, we'll still take a Tesla Model 3 if someone wants to offer it to Pro Tools Reviews as a company car. So, there are only 7 comments to this article. I don't know how many times the article was read, but only 7 comments appear here. The first one, just remember that there is a significant reason that the U.S. has kept a presence in Afghanistan. Besides the opium, there is the next largest deposits of lithium and other significant rare earth elements available. This is to the tune of $1 to $3 trillion worth. They just do not advertise this. They push the other buttons first. That was from Wild Twin Dad. And Mark writes, it would seem to me that if lithium is going to be scarce, then old lithium batteries should be worth something, not just drop for free in the recycle bin. And I don't know. I mean, that seems commonsensical, but I don't know if it's true. I don't know if, the lithium in a spent lithium-ion battery is recoverable. I just don't know. And then I'm going to take them out of order because I want to read the next one last. So skipping the big one. Ron writes, did Big Oil put you up to this? Question mark. And I don't really see what Big Oil gets from this other than, you know, maybe the electric vehicle industry is painted in a slightly bad light here because it's, you know, hogging up all the lithium. That comment has -1 upvotes. And Jerry writes, might be an interesting situation with the rigid LSA batteries. I have 6 that have an LSA, got them with kits. Those are the only LSA ones available. I don't know what an LSA battery is. I thought, wow, is this some new battery technology? Rigid LSA? Well, Rigid is the name of a company, and LSA is Lifetime Service Agreement. So basically, it's a battery with a warranty, and not anything particularly novel in terms of, you know, material science or technology. So finally, Derek writes, can't blame Tesla. They make all their own batteries. I personally don't foresee a battery shortage because a ton of money is being spent on current and future batteries. A lot of money to be had. Someone will always want that money, and they will make batteries to get it. Okay, so first the claim, Tesla makes all their own batteries. As far as I can tell, they intend to in the future. They are working towards that, but so far they still have to buy at least battery cells from other manufacturers. If you are a Tesla fanatic and you know that that is outdated information, please let me know. The second part is basically the implicit argument that says, look, if the future is in batteries and there are subsidies, you know, to be had for developing new types of batteries, and if there is an enormous market, you know, an unmet demand for portable power cells, well, then somebody's going to make it. Yeah. There are all kinds of demands which could be fulfilled by some future technology, which has been a tough nut to crack for a long time. The argument that there's a lot of money to be made for the party that cracks that nut, you know, that means it's going to get cracked, that doesn't follow. You know, there's all kinds of, you know, potential and very profitable applications for a room temperature superconducting material. I've been watching that for 30 years, and as far as I can tell, we're no closer to a marketable product featuring high-temperature superconducting materials than we were in the 1980s. But man, that would be a huge boon, you know, for off-grid power storage or for long-distance transmission of electricity. So, you know, the problem with solar is that the sun only shines half the day and a lot of places are cloudy. You know, you can't really send electricity generated in New York to California because you will lose most of that electricity in the transmission, you know, just in the resistance in the wires. That electricity is going to get turned into heat, waste heat, which just, you know, radiates out and is lost. That wouldn't be the case if you had superconducting transmission lines that continued to be superconducting, which is they conduct electricity without resistance at, you know, the maximum temperature that they might experience out in the real world, like, you know, crossing the Nevada desert. But let's go back to this claim that Tesla makes all their own batteries, and therefore, guys who are really enthusiastic about affordable cordless drills shouldn't be mad at Tesla, because Tesla's not the one taking up those battery cells.
So it's important to note that there is a massive amount of lithium on Earth. Lithium is not like oil. There's a massive amount of it pretty much everywhere. In fact, there's enough lithium in the United States to convert the entire United States fleet to electric. Like all the cars in the United States, there's like 300 million or something like that. Every vehicle in the United States can be converted to electric using only lithium that is available in the United States.
Discovered today.
What we already know is exists.
People really haven't even been looking.
Yeah, people haven't been trying because it's just like widely available. Yeah. So, it is important to say, like, okay, what is the smartest way to take the ore and extract the lithium and do so in an environmentally friendly way? We actually discovered looking at a sort of first principles physics standpoint, instead of just the way it's always been done, is we found that we can actually use table salt, sodium chloride, to extract the lithium from the ore. Nobody's done this before, to the best of my knowledge, nobody's done this. All the elements are reusable. It's a very sustainable way of obtaining lithium. We actually got rights to a lithium clay deposit in Nevada.
Over 10,000 acres.
Over 10,000 acres. And then the nature of the mining is actually, I think, also very environmentally sensitive in that we sort of take a chunk of dirt out of the ground, or remove the lithium, and then put the chunk of dirt back where it was. So it will look pretty much the same as before, and it will not look like terrible, and yeah, it'll be nice. Nice.
Yeah.
All right, well, that was Elon Musk and one of his employees and co-presenter at Battery Day, which took place last summer. And here to talk more with more knowledge and credibility on topics technological is my old friend, Eric Boyd. Eric, Happy New Year. Good to see you again.
Hello. Nice to see you too, Kamo.
So I watched the Battery Day event. You sent me the link, and I, you know, here's a big difference that 2020 made in my life. After, I don't know, a decade or more with no TV in my life, watching everything on, you know, tablets or laptops, I now have a proper TV. It costs about as much as my entry-level phone, and it's got a voice remote. It's a Roku TV. Don't need cable. You know, it's just drawn off the router, just like all my other devices. And it's really nice to sit in a chair, you know, and have the thing over there. And it's just, there's a reason for that device to have that form. And I've been without it for so long. It's just a real novelty to me to be watching proper TV.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I've been watching more. Well, I mean, guess what you call TV, but I'm still watching it on my laptop, and I have been thinking, man, I really do need a big screen.
They're
I'm
so
watch
cheap.
All the streaming content.
They're so cheap. It's crazy.
Yep.
So, you know, when I was married, living in Washington State, I paid several thousand dollars for a big screen TV.
Well, like a plasma job or something?
I don't even remember what it was called, because I'm not all that interested in the underlying tech, other than, you know, it was a cathode ray tube device. So it was enormous. In an enormous cabinet, it was enormously heavy. Mm-hmm. It's now at my mother's house in Arkansas, where it's not functional. I mean, nobody's using it. It's just, you know, it's just a piece sitting among many other pieces, and you couldn't give it away. Nobody would want it. The effort required to remove it from that building would be way more than the possible reward of you know, possessing the thing.
Yep.
So.
I have another interesting fact for you.
Uh-huh.
Those things are now old enough that actually the volume of e-waste is finally declining, because the number of such beasts that are being turned in at the end of life is going down substantially.
Good.
And they form, even now, they still form a substantial like majority of the e-waste material. I mean, if you just think about how big all your modern devices are, like how many smartphones would you have to dispose of to equal one of those? It'd be like
thousands.
A thousand? Yeah. and so the volume of e-waste is substantially declining now that there's not too many of those old bears left.
I mean, when that old TV got delivered to my house, it took two big, burly, professional delivery dudes to muscle it into the house. And when they got it in place, they were beat, you know?
Yep. Man, that's great.
So the TV that replaced it, that which has, you know, it's much higher resolution, much bigger screen, you know,
much
it's got
brighter
this,
too, probably. Yeah, yeah.
16:9 aspect ratio, so it's, you know, cinematic. And I ordered it from Amazon. They mailed it to a friend of mine, because I can't get package deliveries here during COVID. And, you know, she's an older woman, and she just carried it over in her car and, you know, handed it to me. It's like, here mm-hmm. you go.
Yes, it's more awkward than heavy, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So here's the transition. That big monster of a TV that I had back in the very early days of the 21st century, it had a cathode ray tube in it. And if you start talking about lithium ion battery production, you're going to hear the word cathode a lot.
Mm-hmm.
What's a cathode?
I think it's the positive side of a battery. Basically, it's like a piece of metal that attracts electrons.
And so you've got a cathode, an anode, a barrier between them, and you have a medium in which the lithium ions sit. And, yep. you know, they sit on one side of the barrier or the other, and discharging and recharging the battery just moves the lithium ions, depending on, you know, whether it's charging or discharging, from the anode to the cathode or vice versa across that barrier.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was mentioning, you know, just doing some research yesterday about lithium, it's the lightest solid substance.
Yeah. I mean, this is why all battery technology is converging on it, because it has a very favored position in the periodic table.
Although what I didn't realize going in, and which is what I mentioned, I won't detail, you know, recap it in detail, but just that while stars do create lithium, you know, via fusion, they also destroy it in pretty much the same quantities in which it's created. So most of the lithium out in the universe today was created in the Big Bang. And a lot of the lithium that is still in stars, this is the part I found really fascinating, is in stars that are in a binary with some really massive object like a black hole or a neutron star. And the gravity from the black hole or the neutron star is pulling the lithium away from the core of the other body so that it isn't destroyed.
Right. But, it's like creating tidal stirring or whatever. So that, yeah.
But as Elon Musk was saying in that clip that I just played, we got a lot of lithium. Lithium is not the new oil. One, it's not a power source unto itself. You know, it's like a hydrogen fuel cell. It is a storage medium. And two, there's just so much of it. You know, remember when Chris Martinson said we could never electrify the car fleet because there's not enough lithium. He was talking about current lithium production, which was, you know, the product of past demand.
Yeah, and it used to be tiny. It was not an industrial metal because it got hardly used for anything. Mm-hmm. Now that it's industrial metal, people are ramping production fast.
So what did you take from the that Battery Day event, other than just the utter bizarreness of it, of being a parking lot full of people cars?
I mean, I thought that the spectacle of it as a COVID spectacle was part of the enjoyment for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, the other big thing that I took from it is precisely its lack of radicalness. If you spend much time looking at battery technology, you'll find hordes and hordes of people ranting about like solid state lithium batteries and all kinds of like true innovation. And that Battery Day thing was remarkable precisely because there wasn't really any true innovation there. There was a bunch of like clever manufacturing ideas. There was a bunch of like supply chain things. There was a couple of optimizations of the ways in which batteries are actually physically held in the cars. And they added it all together and they got that like 55% or 56% or some number like that improvement. And so like what was remarkable to me was it's sort of representing like the triumph of incrementalism, right? They're taking the existing technology and like, hey, we're going to get 10% here, we're going to get 20% here, we're going to get 15% there, and it all adds up to something big. And they don't need any big breakthroughs, right? Probably the hardest thing that they talked about was the removal of the solubility step. He talked about it for quite a while. I don't really understand it, but basically some of the processes are done wet, and then later you have to dry it. And this is like enormously complicated because you have to buy like, you know, thousands of very expensive machines in order to do it. And they're trying to eliminate that in order to make batteries cheaper. And, you know, it's not really improving the batteries at all. It's improving the way the batteries are made.
So a couple things from my first segment. I had a couple questions, open questions, which that video actually answered for me. Does Tesla manufacture their own batteries? Not exactly, but
not exactly, yeah.
But they've designed their own batteries in conjunction with Toshiba, and Toshiba manufactures them. But you know, Tesla's
I think
building...
it's Panasonic, not Toshiba.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, another electronics giant.
Yeah, another electronics giant. That story is also a little incomplete because in China they partner with a different company called like Cattle or something like that, and you make batteries in partnership with them there, and I think. Similarly, when they open the new Berlin thing, I think they have some kind of battery partner in Europe as well. But
they're building their own battery factories all over the place.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the sort of the essence of what you need to do in order to build more electric cars is every electric car plant needs its own battery plant. Like, and that's why you see all the big companies like Volkswagen, they're announcing, you know, $20 billion we're going to spend on making electric vehicles. And it's not because they need new car factories. They already have car factories. It's because they need new battery factories. And that costs real money.
Right. One of the questions that Elon Musk got in the Q&A at that event was, you know, are you just going to hoard all these batteries that you're making for your own vehicles, or will you sell them to other manufacturers? And he's like, well, you know, if we have a surplus, we'll sell them, but we plan to sell a lot of cars. So,
yeah, I don't think they'll have a surplus. Yeah.
Particularly if they do hit that $25,000 model vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the major points that I came to yesterday, and which I included in the first segment, was that up to this point, if you bought an electric car, you had some other motivation for doing it other than just, you know, expected utility for the dollar you spend.
Yeah.
And that's going away.
Yeah. I mean, you can make an argument already if you're in a sort of a premium segment where, you know, you were going to spend $50,000 on a vehicle. The electric vehicle you can buy for that money now is superior to the ICE vehicle already. But I agree, as the price comes down, like that number is going to get lower and lower. And eventually, it's not going to make sense to buy anything except a battery electric vehicle.
And Elon Musk, in talking about that $25,000, you know, Tesla automobile, just casually tossed off, you know, as a postscript, oh, and it'll be autonomous.
Oh, of course.
And they didn't follow up on it.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, his claims about how soon Tesla vehicles are going to be autonomous are entirely unbelievable at this point. He's been saying it's, you know, 6 months from now for at least 3 years. And in all honesty, like I looked at where their tech is, they're years behind Waymo. And Waymo itself is still years from wide-scale deployment. It's going to be a while.
My understanding is the Tesla's big advantage is the number of autonomous hours that they've logged and the data that's created. So
Yeah. Their so-called ability to monitor the whole fleet. I agree, it gives them a big leg up, but it seems like their dev team is well behind where Waymo is. So like good data helps, but you also are just going to have to spend the time, right?
So on the topic of, you know, are we stuck with lithium ion batteries or is there something better coming? You mentioned solid state lithium batteries. And when I was reading yesterday, I noticed that the parties who are researching that and who are investing in that are the traditional big car manufacturers around the globe. Mm-hmm. You know, the big boys, they think that's the new technology to look for. And then these other esoteric things are being researched by, you know, MIT and the Pentagon and little startups who are hoping to change the world, but, you know, most likely will not. What's your, like, if you go to YouTube and you just search for the future of batteries, your brain will melt with all the technical information are peddling
there. And you get all kinds of crazy stuff that's never going to happen too. Like there's a new announcement about a breakthrough battery, quote unquote, probably once a week. And as far as I can tell, none of those announcements ever result in like batteries that end up in anything you or I could ever buy.
Another point that Elon Musk made in that presentation was that you can build a prototype of something pretty easily, but building a factory to build those things at scale, you know, for a profit, that's the hard part.
That's the hard part, exactly.
And that's probably triply true of batteries.
Yep.
And at the risk of using a buzzword, it sounds like what Tesla is really focusing on, well, one of the things they're really focused on is, you know, a holistic eye when it comes to designing their supply chain and their manufacturing, keeping everything close together, keeping the number of miles that each part has to ship before it is in a car to the absolute minimum.
Yeah. I mean, they are basically masters of vertical integration. If you compare the way Tesla operates to the way that, say, GM operates, the level of vertical integration at Tesla is remarkable. Like in terms of the number of parts they build in-house, GM, of course, outsources to all kinds of, you know, other OEMs like Magna or whatever for all kinds of parts. And Tesla, by and large, doesn't. They build all of their own, you know, dash pieces. They build all their own batteries, everything, basically. And that's remarkable. And it is, I think, one of the sources of their strength. Like it includes stretching out into things like the autonomous vehicle piece, right? They are building all of their own self-driving electronics, which is kind of crazy. They used to have a partnership with NVIDIA to do that, because NVIDIA is the sort of world leader in building hardware for deep learning. But now they build their own chips too. Like it's insane the level of vertical integration they have.
And, you know, Apple is, they're a device manufacturer. You know, they do make hardware, but really they're a software company. Mm-hmm. You know, what's distinctly Apple is not the glass and the plastic and the metal. It's the operating system. And Tesla is very similar to that. Like there's so much computer engineering that goes into that, you know, into their products and into the design and construction of their factories. It makes as much sense to call them a software company as it does to call them an automobile manufacturer.
Yeah. Although I think it's been interesting in the last 2 years to watch Elon Musk himself double down on how important he considers manufacturing to Tesla's long-term viability. Mm-hmm. Like I'm not sure that he thinks of Tesla as a software company anymore. I think he thinks of it as we are a manufacturing powerhouse.
Yeah. I was thinking earlier today that, you know, there's some things you just, we won't be saying in the future. Like you won't talk about an internet company Today, that would be like describing your business as being 100% electrified. You know, we're a 100% electrified pizzeria. It's like, it's not remarkable, you know? It's expected.
yeah, exactly. Everything will be internet-centric, right? Mm-hmm. You won't mention it.
So I started to ask you about your thoughts about the future of battery technology, and then other ideas occurred to me, and I cut you off. So let me back up to that spot. What do you think? What's on your radar for future battery technology?
Well, so I mean, I think that Elon Musk is basically correct. What's going to happen for the next, you know, several years, like 2 through 5, is going to be basically process improvements in the manufacturing of existing technologies in order to make them cheaper. The so-called learning curve, right? Where basically every time you double the number of battery cells that you're manufacturing, you get economies of scale and you learn how to do things slightly better and your batteries get 15% cheaper. That looks to me like absolute ironclad, the future for 2 to 5 years. And then beyond that, I don't know. I mean, if you believe people like Monroe, there is going to be some kind of sort of game changer in the lithium solid state stuff. Solid state basically meaning like instead of inside the battery between the cathode and anode, instead of there being a liquid in there in which the lithium ions are suspended, it's all actually going to be some kind of solid. And the advantage of this is the battery is going to be considerably less flammable, and it's going to be a lot more rigid, and it's going to be a lot easier to manufacture. And the disadvantage right now is nobody knows how to manufacture them. Like you can make them in the lab in like ultra clean conditions, and you know, you get a one-off and it performs great. But when you try to scale it up, there's just all kinds of issues because the precision required with the electrodes and with the whatever that solid material is, it just doesn't work at scale. So I think ultimately somebody is going to figure that trick out, and then you know they're going to have some patents that probably they'll license widely and make billions of dollars on, and that'll change the industry to some kind of solid state lithium battery. But you know it's still. My opinion is it's not likely to result in sort of game-changing levels of performance. Like you're never going to get from the density of current lithium-ion batteries to the density of gasoline. It is just not possible. And as a result, batteries are always going to be the heaviest part of an electric car. Like instead of, you know, the fuel tank currently weighs like 100 pounds or whatever, whereas batteries need to weigh like 700 pounds. And I definitely feel like, you know, with progress...
And they don't get any lighter when they're discharged.
And they don't get any lighter when they're discharged, exactly. Yeah. It stays 700 pounds, yeah. Yeah, and I definitely feel like, you know, we're going to be able to take 700 pounds to 600 pounds or 500 pounds or whatever, but we're never going to get it to 100 pounds. That is just not possible because it basically has to carry its own oxidizer with it. So instead of being able to take in oxygen from the air, it's got to have the oxidizer inside the material, and that's why it's so much heavier.
Well, Eric, I think we risk losing a lot of the C-Realm Vault audience if we get too deep into the weeds in terms of, you know, technical stuff. So let's pull back and talk a little bit more socio-political. I've noticed that a lot of people that I know from the peak oil community, they don't just dislike Elon Musk. They loathe him.
Yeah, I mean, he represents the technological optimist viewpoint sort of to a T, right?
Well, you know, somebody asked him in the Q&A about the ecological, you know, climate change impacts of all the changes they're making. And he said, you know what, when I started on this path, I wasn't even worried about that. I was just thinking that if we don't get off of oil, the economy is going to crash. We have to electrify cars. And I think the peak oil people say, no, we don't need to electrify cars. We need to get back to horses and walking and bicycles and be less mobile, not so focused on productivity and mobility, and live a more authentic life. And Elon Musk is presenting the techno fix to allow us to continue to do the things that a lot of people, I think, you know, rightfully don't like about modern life. But, you know, from my perspective, giving up mobility, that's just not the answer. I mean, it's a answer, but it's not a very desirable answer on the whole. I understand the appeal of it romantically, but yeah, I think the actual downstream experience is going to suck.
So. Actually doing it, no, is terrible. I mean, I you know, I am without car right now. I do the car sharing thing, but the only reason I can do it is precisely because the car sharing exists. Like, you know, the like half a dozen times a year that I want to go outside where public transit makes it easy to get to, I don't hesitate to rent a car. Like, the freedom is, you know, not quite priceless, but definitely an important part of my life.
Well, I don't have a car right now, and I'm doing the don't go anywhere thing.
No, yes, which is a very, very 2020 pandemic thing, I have to say.
Yeah. So I'm sitting here at my laptop editing an Adobe Audition, and I'm looking around for the outro segment. And then I realized, oh, I haven't recorded it yet. So here it is. Here's me saying, that's not the end of the conversation with Eric Boyd. That will continue on the next episode of the Main Sea Realm podcast. And we're not going to continue talking about electric cars or Tesla or lithium-ion battery technology. We have a very wide-ranging discussion about 2020 and the things we liked about it, the things we didn't like about it. You know, it's far less focused than what you heard in this episode of the Sea Realm Vault podcast. And I don't have a date in which I promise to get that free podcast out, but it will be in the coming week. And really, there's not a whole lot else to say other than, hey, folks, we made it out of 2020. We're on the other side. Not saying it's going to be any better. Might be worse. Who knows? But at least 2020 is behind us. So I mentioned some feedback that I received from Leap Minion. I'm going to hold on to that until the next episode of the podcast. Just, you know, to give it it's fair due, not just read it here at the end and give it a skimpy response. So look for that next weekend. And I have some other listener feedback that I might work in there as well. If I get enough of it, I'll do a whole episode that's nothing but listener feedback, you know, and my responses to it. So hit me up, you know. You know where to find me, kmo@c-realm.com. And the Monday through Friday, 2 to 5 p.m. drawing live stream, drawing and, you know, responding to comments resumes tomorrow, Monday. All right, that's all for this episode of the podcast. As always, thank you for subscribing. I will talk to you again quite soon.